with unprecedented resources, I think has to come unprecedented reform. This can't be investment in status quo. We have to get dramatically better.
A whirlwind Alaska trip for members of Obama's cabinet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 12th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a ruling on whether governors can conduct state business on private email accounts.
To have to go to court in order to protect the public's right to know it just amazes me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
An Anchorage judge today declined to put an immediate stop on the governor's office from conducting public business on private email accounts. A Superior Court judge did not grant a summary judgment against the state in a case challenging former Governor Sarah Palin's practice of using her personal Yahoo address instead of her state accounts. The challenge was brought by Anchorage resident Andre McLeod. McLeod's attorney Don Mitchell says the judge agreed with McLeod's argument to a point, but says he was not persuaded to order the practice to be forbidden.
He said that he did not believe, as of this morning, that there were no facts at issue and that Andre McLeod was right as a matter of law with respect to her view of the inappropriateness under the law of the Office of the Governor using private email accounts to conduct public business.
Mitchell says the legal point in the case now hinges on the statutory requirement that all communications must be appropriate for preservation. McLeod says she was stunned by the judge's decision. She says the state's policy is to make all communications available to public records requests, and the former governor's Yahoo account was not available for that access.
For any Alaskan, for any member of the public, to have to go to court in order to get their government to protect the public's right to know it just amazes me. But I guess the laws have not kept up with emails.
Legislation to update the law is pending in the State House of Representatives. Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan introduced a bill earlier this year that would require any official communication to go through the state's electronic system, and it clearly says those messages would be available for public inspection. Dugan says he saw the measure as a way of resolving the issue, and without it, the law would allow technology to bypass what is now illegal.
It's the theory behind public records is the basis of our policy, then simply because the technology has opened up a new loophole doesn't mean that we can take advantage of it. You know, we have to look at our theory and say, that's our theory, we're sticking to it, and we have to adopt it to the new technology as well.
Dugan says he hopes to include the major components of his bill in a rewrite of the Executive Ethics Act anticipated to be before lawmakers during next year's session. The court case will next be considered in a procedural hearing set now for September 21st, where a trial could be scheduled. Education Secretary Arne Duncan met with Anchorage school officials at a brief question-and-answer session yesterday in a gathering hosted by the Cook Inlet Tribal Council. He is in Alaska as part of a rural tour for President Barack Obama. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Duncan brought welcome news to local educators. $200 million in federal stimulus dollars for Alaska to help boost educational resources, and an additional $1.2 million grant for the Anchorage School District for a program aimed at halting the Alaska Native student dropout rate. And for some teachers, the promise of changes to come.
As we go into the new year, we're going to think about reauthorizing the No Child Left Behind law, and we want to take a very pragmatic, non-ideological approach to this. And things that make sense, we want to keep. Things that don't make sense, we want to throw out.
Duncan told educators that under No Child Left Behind, each of the 50 states had its own set of standards, and in many of those states, political pressure lowered the bar. Now most states are looking at creating common standards, and he encouraged Alaska leaders to join the movement. Duncan's audience of school administrators were all ears when he told them the Obama administration is doubling the national education budget, providing billions of dollars for students from preschool to college. He reeled off the numbers, $100 billion in new education money, $5 billion of that for preschool, $70 billion for K-12 students, and more than $30 billion for higher education.
With unprecedented resources, I think has to come unprecedented reform. This can't be investment in the status quo. We have to get dramatically better. There's a series of things that we're pushing for, transparency around data, high common standards, thinking about how we get our best and brightest teachers working in underserved communities, thinking about how we turn around our struggling schools. But think about $100 billion in new money for education. That has not happened in any of our lifetimes. It probably won't happen again.
He said the administration's focus would be on reform and innovation. In a bid to change the nation's education department from, in his words, a compliance-driven bureaucracy to an engine of innovation. Innovations could be a five-year program in high schools for some students to ensure graduates instead of dropouts. And he sees a greater role for community colleges. He said although the No Child Left Behind law narrowed curriculum, it did provide data revealing discrepancies in educational standards for minorities. Questions from the floor put to Duncan included this statement from State Senator Betty Davis.
The one thing that happened, regardless of what changes you make, if the money does not follow the recommendations and mandates, the local government and the school districts will not be able to carry them out. And the biggest problem we have is not getting enough funding from the federal government to cover what they mandate.
But the grant for Anchorage is certain. Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como said she was actually just hearing about the $1 million grant at the session and was not ready to comment. But she said on the whole, Duncan left a positive message.
Well, the most important thing is innovation, creativity. We're going to set the bar high and we're going to expect good outcomes that we can show kids are learning. But how you get there, we're really encouraging innovation and new ideas and partnerships. And to me, that's very exciting. And to me, that's what we should be focusing on.
Duncan made it clear that the Obama administration is looking to education as one means to pull the country out of its economic slump. He said, our students are competing on an international level now. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Last night, the Anchorage Assembly passed a municipal ordinance banning discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. However, the ultimate fate of the measure remains undecided. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The 7-4 vote followed 2 months of highly emotional public hearings. When the time finally came for the Assembly members to speak, the emotion continued. L.V. Gray Jackson was one of the yes votes.
Like a lot of folks, you have family members that are gay, but I have a nephew who's gay, and his mom died in my arms, and I promised to take care of him, and I have. And I want to do the same for the rest of the people in this community that deserve equal rights, just like the rest of us.
Jennifer Johnston mentioned her political mentor, a man devoted to public service whose life ended in suicide. She also spoke of David Rose, an Assembly member who had led the fight for a similar anti-discrimination ordinance in the 1970s.
And so as his memory and this other very special person, I am going to be voting in favor of this ordinance.
The 1970s anti-discrimination proposal passed the Assembly, but the current mayor's father, George Sullivan, vetoed it. It was member Pat Flynn's compromise proposal that won approval last night. It sought to balance protection of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people in housing, employment, financial dealings, and public accommodations, with exemptions for churches and other faith-based organizations. Sheila Selcraig said the compromise should allay the fears of those religious groups that saw the ordinance as a threat.
It allows churches to hire who they choose to hire based on the values within the church. It allows Catholic social services and entities like that to choose their employees in a manner that's compatible with their values. It allows the expectation that men will be in men's restrooms and women will be in women's restrooms.
Flynn himself spoke of a highly popular neighborhood mailman whose route for decades included the assembly member's home. When the mailman recently retired, Flynn said he found a note in his mailbox.
Patrick, I appreciate what you tried to do. I'm retiring to Asheville, North Carolina, a progressive city, on August 2nd. Glenn.
Bill Starr said while some of the individual experiences of prejudice were tough to hear, he did not feel they established the need for an anti-discrimination ordinance.
I saw no broad sweeping indication of blatant harassment or a sense of bias that was communicated. I don't see signs that say no gays allowed, lesbians in the back, things such as indicators that are blatant.
Chris Birch agreed, saying he had seen no statistical evidence of discrimination.
We live in a tolerant community. I have not seen where we have a demonstrated problem in this community.
Although she voted against the ordinance, Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander felt Anchorage did have a discrimination problem.
I have a deep belief in the importance of protecting our citizens and being respectful to all of our citizens. In the course of the last 2 months, I've come to the belief that there are some citizens who need more protection than we're giving them.
At the same time, Osiander felt the ordinance might place too many demands upon small businesses. Osiander, Birch, Starr, and Dan Coffey voted against the ordinance. Flynn, Gray Jackson, Johnston, Selkraig, Harriet Drummond, Mike Gutierrez, and Matt Klayman voted in favor. Backers of the anti-discrimination ordinance were pleased with the vote, but also aware that the battlefield has now moved from the Assembly Chamber to the 8th floor of City Hall and Mayor Dan Sullivan's office. Pastor Jerry Prevo of the Anchorage Baptist Temple has opposed similar anti-discrimination efforts since the 1970s.
We will encourage the mayor to veto it, and if he doesn't veto it, then we would consider getting an initiative going and have the people to vote it down by the April election.
The mayor, who declined to comment on last night's passage, has 7 days to veto the anti-discrimination ordinance. It would take 8 votes on the assembly to override his veto. This is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bars in Alaska's most notorious fishing town go smoke-free with some reluctance.
If you're in the bar all night drinking, you're obviously not that much of a health nut that you're so worried about secondhand smoke.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A number of claimants in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case who have received punitive damages from the company haven't cashed their settlement checks yet. Last week, a notice appeared on the Exxon Qualified Settlement Fund website, exspill.com, urging plaintiffs to cash their checks as soon as possible. Mike Warner is a lawyer with the Seattle-based firm of Keller Rohrbach, which administers the fund.
People run the risk that if they go in to cash them after too much time has passed, they could incur bank charges. And so from their perspective, I think they'd want to avoid that happening. And we've got a lot going on, and administratively, it just creates some headaches from our end because when we get a call from a bank that somebody's check is now attempting to be cashed and it's after a certain amount of time has passed, it just takes more work on our part. Plus, it makes things a little bit more complicated when we go to issue the same person another check when we get more money from Exxon, because we need to account for prior payments, and we've issued the prior payment, but the check hasn't been cashed. And so there's just some administrative burden on our end that we'd prefer not to have to deal with, so that we can instead be focusing on getting money out to folks.
The settlement fund began distributing checks late last year. The website says the number of checks that remain uncashed is substantial, but Warner wouldn't give an exact figure.
We just don't think it's appropriate to do that. There are security issues, and we just don't think it's appropriate to be publicizing that.
Many claimants are still upset about the amount of their settlement checks. In June of last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that punitive damages should not exceed compensatory damages that effectively reduced the size of the award to one-tenth of the amount that an Anchorage jury originally gave plaintiffs in 1994, from $5 billion to $507.5 million. The company also owes interest on the ruling, totaling an additional $500 million. More than 30,000 fishermen, processing workers, and Alaska Natives are claimants in the case. Warner says if a claimant has lost his or her settlement check, they should go to the EX Spill website and contact a claims administrator to have it reissued as soon as possible. In Juneau, a new nonprofit has big plans for the site of what was once the world's largest gold mine. Between 1882 and 1922, the Treadwell Mine yielded nearly $70 million in gold. That's equivalent to roughly $1.5 billion today. The Treadwell Historic Preservation and Restoration Society seeks to promote and preserve what remains of the Treadwell Mining Complex and bring part of it back to life. Recently, the Society outlined its priorities for the project to the CBJ Parks and Recreation Advisory Committee. Rebecca Shear has more.
Mosey down the Treadwell Historical Trail on Douglas Island, and you might happen upon a particular rock.
I want to show you this rock with a plaque on it.
And as Juneau mine historian David Stone will tell you,
this plaque was placed here in 1983. It was written by Philip Reed Bradley, Jr. His uncle was the president, and his dad was the superintendent.
President and superintendent of the Treadwell Mine, the operations of which Bradley describes in his inscription.
And it says, shaft depth reached more than 2,800 feet, 5 mills dropped, 960 stamps, gold production totaled some 3.3 million ounces.
But the key, Stone says, is what Bradley writes at the very end.
Daily payroll long exceeded more than 1,000 men. Life here was good.
Life here was good.
Right.
That good life is what the Treadwell Historic Preservation and Restoration Society, which David Stone, Mayor Bruce Botello, and former Assemblyman Rich Poor incorporated as a nonprofit in 2008, seeks to recapture.
I mean, we've all heard that Treadwell was a town of 2,000, but what does that mean? What was there, and what did they do?
A heck of a lot, it turns out. Society President Paulette Simpson is especially impressed by the town's self-sufficiency.
They had a bakery, dairy cows, a meat market,
general store. They had a women's clothing store, had a men's department store.
Then there was the post office, the firehouse, the school.
500-seat auditorium. They had vaudeville shows. When silent pictures came out, they had them.
Phil Bradley Sr., who paid higher wages than any other mine superintendent in the world, also provided such diversions as billiards, bowling, an indoor swimming pool.
And there were two tennis courts, there's one right down here.
All that remains today are some rusted out net poles, scraps of chicken wire fencing.
See how the spruce tree is lifting up the concrete?
That was the floor of the tennis court?
Floor of the tennis court, yes.
And that's the case with pretty much everything along the trail.
Because of a fire in 1926, there's just very little left. And what's remarkable is it's just so overgrown that nobody knows what this was all about. I shouldn't say nobody, but most people don't.
Like the old office building, which many know as the old hospital, since that was what replaced the original structure.
The old office was here, and then the company store was right next to it. I've got a picture for you.
We are right here standing in that building.
We're in the building. We're outside, but we're in the building.
Right.
That's blowing my mind.
The society aims to restore the building and create a museum.
There are so many families who have so many artifacts, and their children or their grandchildren may not have an appreciation for what those were and what they're about. So what we are hoping is that we can develop a repository for what life was like here.
Simpson says they would love to restore and recreate the entire complex, including the electric Treadwell Express that transported goods and people throughout town.
Would you have an actual train?
At some point, it would be great to have. But I say when we talk about this project that I'm on the 10-year plan. The train might be the 20-year plan. The 10-year plan would be to get the museum done.
but none of the Society's plans sit well with Juneau resident and historian Dee Longenbaugh.
It's a very pleasant area. Many people just like to walk over there. In the winter, it's nice because the trees break the wind, and Douglas winds are famous. But you're taking a pleasant walking experience, and it doesn't sound like they're preserving anything other than just making a big mess.
David Stone contends they're not messing with the site, but rather...
We want to interpret the place.
With, for instance, more detailed signage.
So that when people come and walk down here, they can say, wow, that was here?
In the meantime, the Society is collecting information and photographs for its website. Over the next few months, it will do an archaeological survey of the actual site.
To delineate where each building was, because we don't want to disturb, you know, we may find some great stuff in the ground. We want to be very cautious about how we go about this.
Then they can apply for grants. They'll also look to contributions, donations, and collaboration with the city, which has owned the property since 1972. CBJ has its own master plan for the area, which city officials believe is in harmony with the Society's vision. David Stone and Paulette Simpson won't estimate a total cost for that vision, though they acknowledge that the museum alone could run at least $2 million. But Stone says it's worth it.
It's just an amazing story that needs to be told, and that everybody in Juneau and Douglas can take pride in. Because it's more than just a gold mine. There's an amazing social side of this that you don't know when you walk through here.
Though in a few years, or 10, or 20, the Treadwell Historic Preservation and Restoration Society hopes everyone who walks the trail will know about the mine, the town, and the good life that, once upon a time, 2,000 pioneering Alaskans had the opportunity to lead. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Four cabinet secretaries flew to Bethel today. Their flights were delayed by 3 hours, so their agenda was pushed back throughout the day. But YK Delta residents still had about an hour to meet with the secretaries in a town hall meeting before the entourage flew out to Hooper Bay. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes has the story.
The delay was for two reasons. The mornings in Bethel have been foggy, and there were technical difficulties with the secretary's plane out of Anchorage. Moderator of the town hall meeting, Senator Mark Begich, said it was bringing the secretaries to the reality of the bush.
They got a true Alaskan opportunity to be here by the travel delays, which we appreciate because it gives them a sense of the vastness of our great state, but also what can happen when a plane pilot says we have mechanical issues.
At the Cultural Center, it was packed with residents from all over the YK Delta anticipating the arrival of the secretaries. Edward Adams of Nunaumaqua said he would try to speak on behalf of the elders and those who carry on the subsistence way of life.
I hope that the views that we present to the secretary would be considered seriously, since we are the hardest hit by the disasters in the recent years with fuel, fishing, and now our subsistence way of life is being threatened by limitations of what we can get.
Time was very limited due to the delay. The individual breakout sessions with the secretaries were canceled for the day. The town hall meeting was cut short, too. Everyone was limited to 3 minutes to talk. Some of the questions and comments came from average residents, and others came from agency heads. One was Matthew Nikolai, president of Chilista, the regional native for-profit corporation for 56 villages in the YK Delta. He told the secretaries that funding needed to continue coming through the Denali Commission.
We've been using federal funding through the Denali Commission repairing the bulk tanks. We've been addressing the water sewer problem. We have the highest hepatitis rates in America. And by getting rid of water, you know, the sanitation problems that we have in our villages, the funding formula comes through that. That's very important.
Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu said that he sees global warming and high energy costs as being especially problematic in rural Alaska.
I'm particularly struck by the fact that how much of people's incomes are spent on energy, and that cutting an energy bill by a factor two here means a whole lot than cutting an energy bill by a factor two in the lower 48. And so this is something where I will go back and we'll try to figure out how to help Alaska cut your energy bills by a factor 2 or 3 or 4.
Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Sean Donovan said family homelessness in rural and suburban areas has increased 56% in the last year. He said they are trying to address this in the federal recovery bill.
We have to find ways to increase the availability of housing more broadly. And that's why, under this president, we're going to have a national housing policy that isn't just about homeownership. It's going to be about increasing homeownership and rental housing as well.
The high dropout rate in the region was brought up at the public meeting. In Bethel, it's around 40% from year to year. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan said that he's convinced that Americans have to educate the way to a better economy.
People want to dramatically improve the quality of education. As you and I talked about, we have to, the status quo, frankly, isn't good enough. We have to dramatically reduce the dropout rate. We have to dramatically increase graduation rates. And we have to stop doing things in Washington that get in the way of progress.
Duncan also said No Child Left Behind needs to be changed to better fit local needs. After the town hall meeting, Secretary of the USDA Tom Vilsack said he did notice significant differences between rural Alaska and the rest of the country.
I would just say one other thing. The word subsistence may have a significantly different definition here than it does in the lower 48. Here it is a way of life. It is tradition. It is the tribal values and generational values. And that is something I think that's important for policymakers to understand.
The secretaries also took the opportunity to announce new funding in the region and around the state. The USDA announced $5 million to AVCP Regional Housing Authority based in Bethel and $2 million to Mountain Village on the lower Yukon River. The Education Department announced $2.3 million to the Aleutians campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Housing and Urban Development announced the creation of a tribal conservation district in the village of Gweethluk, located 15 miles upriver of Bethel. It is the third conservation district in Alaska and the 33rd in the country. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
This summer's massive wildfires are likely a symptom of climate warming. That's the take from University of Alaska Fairbanks forest ecologist Glenn Jude. Jude says the individual occurrence of high fire years is not unusual, but their increasing frequency is.
In the past, we had longer stretches of these cooler, more normal conditions for the boreal forest, and those were punctuated by really short, sharp, almost individual peak burning years.
2009 could join 2004 and 2005 on the list of Alaska's top five wildfire years on record. So far this summer, more than 2.9 million acres have burned. Last summer was cool and wet. Conditions, Jude says, used to be more the norm.
What is distinctly different now is that we have broader shoulders. There's more burning on the way up to the peak years and more burning on the way down from the peak years. And I think that's how I'd characterize what's happening here in the summer of 2009. We shouldn't be at a particular peak. It should be a few more years out. And yet we're accumulating some pretty substantial area burned.
The average number of 79-degree or over days in Fairbanks is 11. Fairbanks has had 25 days when the maximum temperature reached 79 or above so far this summer. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Homer, Rebecca Shear in Juneau, and Dan Brass in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.